that actually the Soviet leadership didn't want to go into Afghanistan. It was trying to avoid it. And it was only when they decided that it was unavoidable that they actually felt, well, that's when they needed to have a decapitating strike against the PDPA's leadership, because Amin was just so brutal and trying to essentially reshape the country, a country that didn't want to be reshaped, at breakneck speed, that he was actually becoming the problem. But generally speaking, you know, there was so much misunderstanding about the nature of the country and the nature of the situation, and a willingness to ignore the military's own perspectives. It's quite striking that unlike Gerasimov, who seems to have been entirely willing just to keep his mouth shut and nod along as if he were some little bobbing head puppet on the dashboard of the car Putin was driving towards the precipice, well, his counterparts at the time, people like Chief of the General Staff Marshal Agarkov or General Akhramayev, who later on would also become Chief of the General Staff, they were very, very keenly aware of just how badly suited the Soviet military, designed as it was for big mass mechanized clashes on the plains of Europe or perhaps even northern China, was for this kind of scrappy counterinsurgency in a country with a lot of very, very high mountains and generally rough relief. But the point is, not only were they not able to get through to the leadership, they were actively suppressed. The defense minister, Marshal Ustinov, who was not a military man despite his chest full of medals, again, certain reminiscences of the current incumbent, but Ustinov was a drinking buddy of Brezhnev's, didn't want to disappoint him, and actually barred Agarkov from directly briefing the Politburo and saying all the things that remained unsaid. So Ustinov was blandly promising Brezhnev that it would be basically a walk in the park, even while his own generals were warning him of what a mistake it would be. But the point is, this was driven not so much by these kind of practical assumptions, but by a very zero-sum notion of world politics. Remember, this was just after the Iranian Revolution, so there was genuine fear about sort of Islam on the march, and there was a fear that if Afghanistan went jihadist, then that would in due course infect, quote-unquote, the Central Asian parts of the Soviet Union. But more to the point, there was this belief that essentially countries, all that really matters is who controls them, who owns them, for want of a better word. And there was a certain amount of, frankly, nonsense, but nonetheless, reporting from the local KGB resident in Kabul and others to the effect that Amin was contemplating, if the Soviets weren't going to give him the assistance he would want, he would actually turn to the Americans. And so it was this sense of basically, you know, if we don't control it, the Americans will. And if the Americans do, then they'll be able to have radar bases and missile stations, you know, right in our southern flank. So, you know, there was that degree to which it was that notion that not only that where a red flag is unfurled, it cannot be brought down, but also that ultimately it's to stop the Americans from getting it. And a final particular point that's worth noting about Afghanistan is the degree to which it actually needed leadership change to end the war. I mean, Brezhnev started the war. Soon thereafter, he dies. Yuri Andropov, who takes over. Andropov had always had a rather ambivalent position. On the one hand, he was actually quite sceptical about invading Afghanistan. But at the same time, he was positioning himself to be General Secretary. And it seems to be that he didn't feel he could afford to look half-hearted in his support of Soviet interests and the cause of the revolution, and therefore, you know, he also was one of the forces ultimately pushing for this intervention while trying to keep it limited. When he became General Secretary, he began to actually try and see if there was room for some kind of negotiated withdrawal, but the point is he very quickly succumbed to his kidneys, spent most of his very brief tenure as General Secretary plugged into a dialysis machine, didn't have what in modern terms we would call the bandwidth to be able to do anything about it. Ultimately, it would be not his immediate successor, Chernyenko, but then Gorbachev, who would actually broker a withdrawal. But the point is, again, it needed someone else in the Kremlin, someone who ultimately, explicitly or not, could more or less say, this was someone else's war. This is the interesting thing, that Gorbachev could legitimately say that he was not part of any of the discussions about the invasion. So that's something to bear in mind. So why was I sort of drawing this comparison beyond, obviously, there's these general points? Well, the specific point I was making was actually about participation rates and casualty rates. All told, about 1 million Soviets at some point or another cycled through service in Afghanistan in the course of this 10-year war. Most of them were soldiers, but some of them were civilians. Everyone from doctors and engineers who were drafted in to run clinics and build roads, to, you know, even people like the Aeroflot pilots, who were often pressed into service bringing troops in, and so even though they were on civilian planes, they had to run the gauntlet of anti-aircraft missiles and the like. So, 1 million Soviets out of a total population of about 285 million, which means, roughly speaking, a 0.35% participation rate over 10 years. Now, if one looks at the Russian involvement in Ukraine. I mean, first of all, obviously Russia is much smaller than the Soviet Union. It was only one part of the Soviet Union. But so far, it seems to have sent about 500,000 people to the war. Now, some people have suggested that that figure is too low. I'm not convinced, because I think that some of the figures we've had about, for example, how many troops the Russians had built up around the borders at the beginning of the war were exaggerated. But anyway, your figures may vary, but mine is about 500,000 Russians have been through or are currently in Ukraine. Of course, that's out of a population of 143 million or so, which, when you look at it, again, means something like a 0.35% participation rate. So already, and after all, the war is by no means, alas, over, already Russians have, shall I say, experienced war in Ukraine to the same degree that Soviets experienced war in Afghanistan, and as I said, it's only continuing. But perhaps even more telling should be considered the death rates. In the full 10 years of the Afghan war, the Soviets lost, roughly speaking, 15,000 people. So far, in what, the first year and a half or so of the war in Ukraine, the Russians have lost, well, again, figures vary, but let's be conservative and put it at around 50,000. I mean, some people say it's double that, which I think is way over the odds. But anyway, if we say 50,000, what this means is that the death rate in Afghanistan was 1.5%. So in other words, for every 100 soldiers who went into Afghanistan, 1.5 would not make it home. What about Ukraine then? We're talking about 10% there. I mean, this is devastating. One last bit of statistical comparison. Let's think of this in terms of the death rate as a proportion of the population. In Afghanistan, it was 0.005%, which again, I think, helps give a sense of the degree to which this was politically shocking, socially impactful, but ultimately, in grand terms, not very significant event. It's worth noting, after all, that at peak, 40,000 Soviets died in road accidents per year. Compare that to an average of 1,500 dying in Afghanistan. But what about Russians in Ukraine? Well, here the death rate is 0.035%. Now, again, statistically, not that big, but it's seven times higher than the war in Afghanistan. So let's think about what are the likely effects of all this conflict. And let me start. I mean, I think I'll probably take a break in a moment. But before I do, let me insert one absolutely necessary and, at one point in my life, deeply depressing caveat. Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan, did not bring down the Soviet Union. You'll often see kind of neat little assertions to that effect, because after all, you know, the war in Afghanistan goes through until 1988, Soviet Union by that point is already in terminal decline and is wound up at the end of 1991. Look, I did my PhD on the impact of the Afghan war on the Soviet Union. And so this inevitable, very human, I would say, desire for the subject of your PhD to be of truly world-shaping importance. And so, you know, as I did my research, it was with a growing sense of despondency that I had to appreciate that it wasn't, that it did not bring down the Soviet Union. It was actually, in many ways, a relatively bearable cost, especially when compared with so many others. However, that does not mean that it was not significant. in other ways. And above all, what really mattered was the way that the Afghan war became a metaphor, shall we say, a way of talking about all the other things that you felt were wrong with the Soviet Union. So when you were talking about Afghanistan and, let's say, the bad decision-making, it was actually also just simply a way of saying that we are run by fools and incompetents who don't care about us. When you're talking about the plight of Afghan veterans coming back and not getting the necessary medical assistance and social assistance that they needed, it was also a way of talking about just generally the collapse, frankly, of the Soviet health system and the fact that corruption had become so deeply ingrained that you had to pay to get anything like what you were entitled to. Or indeed, Afghanistan was used as a way of acceptably talking about your local ethnicity's feeling that it is especially heavily oppressed and exploited by the Soviet leadership. So in other words, actually a whole gamut of different criticisms, concerns and complaints that people had about the system could be aired and discussed by apparently talking about Afghanistan. And in some ways this ended up being good for the veterans because it allowed their own issues and situations to be aired. But also often it was actually deeply problematic because it really meant that their real concerns got hijacked by wider discussions. So what I'm going to do is, after the break, is go through a variety of areas in which actually, based on what the Afghan experience can tell us, we can explore what this war may mean for the Russian Federation. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So let me start by picking up on that last point, which is the ethnic politics. Because as I say, what I found fascinating when I was doing my field research, this was in the period of 1988 to 91, which ironically was a great time to do field research, miserable time to be in the Soviet Union, but it was a great time to do research for the simple reason that people understood that the old rules, the old constraints no longer applied, but didn't know what the new ones were. So to a degree, you could get away with anything as long as you acted confident and just basically said that it had been approved somewhere else. Anyway, the thing that struck me was when talking to particularly veterans, but also other observers from different constituent republics of the Soviet Union, was that pretty much everywhere I experienced the same thing, which is people would say, the thing is, our boys are being sent there disproportionately. We are suffering greater losses. We are experiencing a greater burden. And in some cases, but not always, but there was a direct corollary, which is, and this is being done by the Kremlin specifically to bleed our people, to take away the best and the brightest of our young men. So it was almost a sense that it was some kind of long-term deliberate genocide. Now, that was always something that's very difficult to actually assess because the Soviets never put out participation rates that were broken down by nationality or by the region from which they came. However, I did one day manage to find casualty rates which were broken down by republic, by constituent republic. And the fascinating thing is there, when I put together the casualty rates with the share of the overall Soviet population, they actually correlated pretty directly. There were some slight disproportions, I mean Turkmen's, but in part that's because, for the reasons of surprise, the initial invading force had been drawn from the Turkmenistan military district, so that you know they were particularly heavily involved in the first wave. And actually Russians and Ukrainians, but again that was because they were disproportionately represented amongst the paratroopers, who basically were used for a lot of the toughest fighting. But the Balts, the Georgians and so forth, who were so convinced that they were the ones who were suffering the most, actually, they basically were participating at the level one would expect, or indeed in some cases actually just below that level. So what was happening was, again, that people made assumptions about how the state treated them, and they overlaid those assumptions onto the realities of Afghanistan. And this is particularly interesting because, unlike the Soviet system, the Russian Federation has clearly made choices that do mean that there is a very, very sharp distinction, not just the obvious one, between, you know, the affluent people who can basically bribe their way out and the impoverished ones who can't, but also in terms of, by not using sort of the overall conscript base, what's actually happened is precisely that people from the North Caucasus, the Buryats, the Tevens, and others, various minority ethnicities, are taking a heavier share of the fighting and the dying. And it's not, I think, a direct policy. It is rather the fact of impact of the determination to not use conscripts. Because what happens is, therefore, you rely on reservists. Reservists are people who, essentially, the decent reservists, are people who've actually served as volunteers in the past. So you're using volunteer soldiers and former volunteer soldiers disproportionately. Where do you get these soldiers? Well, like almost every army, it to a large extent recruits from impoverished regions. Places where, at least before the war, actually a military career seemed a pretty viable one, an opportunity to get out of your hometown, to acquire a skill, to make some money, and so forth. So this is why these people are disproportionately involved. But the interesting thing is that because Putin is still holding back from either sending in conscripts, which is actually, you know, the conscript base is much more proportionate to the overall distribution of young men throughout the military, though even that, I mean, young men, regions with high birth rates, particularly in the North Caucasus, have more young men. But he's also at the moment holding back from another mobilization wave, because it looks likely that the next mobilization wave will not only be politically unpopular, which is why Putin's holding back, but also increasingly not so much people who are volunteers, but people who are conscripts. So in other words, the actual mobilization would inevitably create short-term political crisis. This is why I think he wants to hold off, if he can, until after the September elections, regional elections. But on the other hand, ironically, do something to address the ethnic disproportions of the people in the war. So once again, sort of Putin, looking for a short-term easy fix, is actually feeding to a longer-term issue. Does this mean that the ethnicities of Russia will rise up and form ethnic republics and so forth? Well, no, because this is the interesting thing. If one looks, for example, at Buryatia, which, although it's called Buryatia and is sort of regarded as the titular republic of the Buryats, in fact, if you look at them, there are more Russians than Buryats living there now. And if one looks at the soldiers who have been fighting and dying, they are more likely to come from Buryatia than from many other regions of the Russian Federation. But on the other hand, there's no appreciable difference between ethnic Russians and ethnic Buryats from Buryatia. What this means, I'm sorry if this is getting over confusing and I'm managing to be excessively convoluted in this, but what matters is not actually your ethnicity. What matters is where you come from. And to be blunt, whether you come from a poor and politically marginalised region or a wealthy one. So I don't think this is necessarily directly going to create ethnic resistance to the centre, though it may, particularly in the North Caucasus. But I think instead it will contribute to regional pressures, a sense that basically the effete leaders in Moscow and the fancy Dan cosmopolitans of Moscow City and Moscow region and St. Petersburg, you know, basically they are getting out of doing the heavy lifting. We out in the provinces, we in the outlying republics, we're actually having to do all the hard work, and that means grunt work and blood work. And this, I think, will contribute to an issue that I've talked about in the past, which is precisely that as the Putin system becomes more and more under pressure, as it becomes, to be frank, much more exploitative over the regions, increasingly we're going to see a pushback. And this pushback will not be overt, because you still can't challenge this overweening state. It will be, as in late Brezhnevism, a covert one, in which actually local cabals of officials and business people and even security figures, aware that Moscow is now an increasingly distant, distracted and exploitative force, not expecting that Moscow is going to provide them with any real benefits in the future, instead conspire to cheat Moscow, to pad the figures, to claim that they need more, to claim that they can provide less. I mean, this is what tends to happen in this huge, diffuse, disparate country, is actually the control mechanisms become themselves corrupted, and that essentially locals will do their best to look after themselves in those times in which Moscow seems both distracted and also predatory and exploitative. And again, I think, so this is, I think, you know, this is how the war will play out and mobilize. It's another example of how Moscow makes stupid decisions and expects us to pay for it. Well, we're not going to put up with that. And that leads me on to this, the second point, exactly this notion that the war becomes an example of the fact that you're being governed by the corrupt, the incompetent, and the, quite frankly, past their sell-by date. Because, after all, let's be honest, just as with Afghanistan, it's very hard for the Russians plausibly to think that there's going to be some kind of victory coming out of the war in Ukraine now. At best, you think you'll be able to find some way of salvaging something that you can spin as a success, but which is clearly in no way matching the cost of how this has been bought. But more broadly, it means that the leadership finds itself with no easy or possible answers. I mean, look, I don't think for the moment that Putin is looking for an out. I would love to believe so, but no, I mean, I think he's convinced himself of two things. One, that this is politically existential for him, that if he does not manage to secure something that looks like a victory, then he is seriously at risk. A feeling that has probably been, I think, sort of deepened by Prigozhin's mutiny. But the second thing is a belief, a hope, a desperation to believe that just over the horizon there is the fragmentation of the West and its will to continue to support Ukraine. Therefore, if he hangs on, there is a chance for that kind of victory. But let's say there is some kind of epiphany and he realizes that that's not going to happen. Well, even then, can he just pull out now? I mean, in theory, absolutely. And on the one level, you'd think, well, who on earth would actually resist that? But he must be aware precisely of the degree to which there is now a nationalist flank that is looking at him with suspicion. And the very reason for crackdowns, and for example, the recent arrest of Igor Girkin, known as Strelkov, who for so long had been able to be very critical of the war as a whole, the war effort, how it's prosecuted, the specifics of, you know, Defense Minister Shoigu, whom he dubbed the plywood marshal, but also, unlike, for example, Prigozhin, Putin himself. I mean, yes, Strelkov Girkin had been particularly directly criticizing Putin right before his arrest, but even before then, I mean, his repeated use of the term "our unique strategic advantage" for Putin was so obviously deeply tongue-in-cheek that, you know, there was no question but what he felt. But the point is, for so long, Girkin had been given latitude, in my opinion, precisely because there was an awareness that he, in some way, spoke for such a large proportion of people within the sort of middle ranks of the military and the security apparatus. And so there was a desire, firstly, to give them a pressure vent, secondly, better not to actually drive them all underground, but thirdly, better also not to actually annoy and alienate the people who ultimately you depend upon for your own security. But so they finally decided, nope, this is too dangerous, we actually have to start rounding up the most outspoken critics of the regime. We'll see how far it goes. But again, I mean, I think it does show that Putin himself is now aware that he can't take the nationalist flank for granted. So how could he actually pull out of this? Again, this is where we go back to the Afghan parallel. I mean, even Gorbachev, who years before had concluded that this was a stupid war and needs to be ended, even before he was General Secretary and could actually really see the full impacts. But even so, Gorbachev had to operate within a political system in which he had to build some kind of, however grudging, consensus within the elite that the withdrawal had to be done. And therefore, we had the irony that, in fact, the first year or so of Gorbachev's time in power saw, if anything, an escalation of operations in Afghanistan. What Gorbachev had to do was more or less give the generals free rein. Say, OK, fine, try and win this war, or get us to a place where it looks as if this is winnable. And it was only after they had, you know, bombed and shelled and so forth to their heart's content, was it possible for Gorbachev to not only turn to them and say, you see, this is not going to be a war we can win. And let's be honest, there were also many within the military who fully understood this. But also he could turn to the political leadership and say, look, I gave it a go. And yet we're no closer to victory, therefore we have to extricate ourselves. Now, Gorbachev was operating, obviously, in a very different political context. He had a razor-thin, or indeed arguably artificial, majority within the Politburo and the Central Committee, but also the Communist Party had its own rules and structures, which meant that Gorbachev could be toppled by something short of, you know, essentially a coup. But still, the point is that one of the key assets that Gorbachev had was that precisely he could say, this was not my war. He could say that to the Soviet people, but he could also say to Western interlocutors with which he had to deal, because this is the thing. Ultimately, the West had to help Gorbachev pull out of Afghanistan. The West could have turned around and been incredibly punitive and bloody-minded and said, no, you want to pull out and end this what Gorbachev called bleeding wound, then, you know, just do it. But instead, the West worked with him to provide him with the sort of kind of security guarantees, which in effect provided him with a political fig leaf. So that he could say, look, we went in, you know, arguably it was a bad move, but nonetheless, we did some good things, we built roads and schools, and we stopped anarchy from breaking out. Whatever narrative he wanted to use. And the West was willing to provide some way in which actually there could be a deal, so that, and the hope was this, the regime that followed the Afghan withdrawal under Babrak Karmal's successor, Dr. Najibullah. And again, you always have to wonder, Dr. Najibullah had previously been head of the Khad, which is the Afghan secret police, the Afghan's answer to the KGB. What makes a medical doctor join a very brutal secret police force? You know, one has to have some notion of, shall we say, the specialities he brought to bear. He was actually a quite ruthless and effective leader. And ironically enough, his regime, although it didn't last long, it actually did manage to outlast the Soviet Union. But still, again, it was about providing that kind of appearance of not peace at any price, but that a deal had been struck. This is, I think, going to in due course be crucial about Ukraine. Not, I think, in terms of the initial sort of end of the shooting war, but, you know, a long-term lasting peace, which will also address all the various other ways that Russia could, if it chooses, mess with Ukraine. I think it's very hard to imagine that being concluded while Putin is still in the Kremlin, not least because he's such an unreliable interlocutor. Just look at the grain deal. But also beyond that, simply because he clearly does not believe that Ukraine has a right to be a sovereign nation. So this is why I think a true peace will almost invariably mean a post-Putin peace of some kind. Third area I want to look at is essentially social crisis. I mean, again, with Afghanistan, you know, given the scale of the deployment wasn't so huge, a lot of the talk about a so-called lost generation was deeply overblown. But nonetheless, there was an issue here. The Afghansi, the veterans of that war, you know, did come back facing not just a considerable degree of social pressure. Veterans of wars that are lost tend, unfortunately, not to be treated kindly in any society. But also, you know, the sheer lack of resources. In fact, this was a collapsing Soviet Union. So they were meant to have all kinds of privileges, particularly the ones who have been wounded. And yet, they couldn't get them because of corruption, because of scarcity. Remember once talking to an Afghan veteran who had no legs. Basically, he had been in a BTR, armored personnel carrier, when they ran over a mine. And he was dragged out, but unfortunately his leg stayed behind. And, you know, he basically obviously needed prosthetic limbs. He has legs down to about the knee. And he was saying, he had these prosthetic limbs by the time I met him. But he was saying that at first when he was told that, yes, his prostheses are ready. So he went to the hospital to have them fitted. And the doctor said, no, I can't do that because you haven't given me a certificate to say that you don't have legs. And he pointed at his stumps and said, well, here you go. No. Sorry, need a piece of paper. Now, clearly this was actually essentially an opportunity to try and extort a bribe. He was a, you know, son of, I'm trying to think, train driver? No. Tram driver, I think it was. Anyway, so he didn't have the money. Fortunately, he had friends, fellow Afghansi, who basically sort of, manhandled him into the back of a larder, and they went off and found a doctor who was going to charge less. He'd still charge, though, to provide some little spravka, some little piece of paper that said, yes, this person has no legs. Then they had to take him back to the hospital, and he got his, frankly, very ill-fitting and not working very well, but nonetheless, his prostheses. And this was being recounted to me in a depressing sense of normalcy. You know, this is not something that was outrageous. It was, as far as this guy was concerned, I mean, this is the way it is. No wonder that so many Afghansi did end up being, feeling thoroughly alienated. And we had the issues of drug use. A lot of them had been exposed to opiates while they were in Afghanistan and brought it back home with them. It's worth noting that even today, the Russian Federation has a catastrophically high level of heroin use. They brought back a general sense of anomie, of social dislocation, of just not feeling part of mainstream society. For some, that just meant dropping out. I mean, obviously, look, most veterans adjusted and adapted and got back. But we're talking about the minority. And for some of that minority who felt cut off from the mainstream society, we saw them drifting into criminality, and particularly violent criminality. I mean, this is a problem. You have, relatively young men. In many cases, they become, to a degree, slightly sort of adrenaline junkie. They have become not just sort of combat scarred, but they're combat trained. What is the one skill that is in demand that they bring back with them to Civvy Street? It is precisely the will and the capacity to use violence. And therefore, this was, after all, a time of rising, the emergence of organized crime within the Soviet Union. So Afghansi became disproportionately involved as enforcers, contract killers, and the like for this new brand of organized crime, contributing to its the violence on the streets. And even, frankly, the Afghan veterans movement became, in some ways, in some aspects, almost an organized crime phenomenon itself. As a way, this particularly happened in the 1990s, but actually they were given a whole variety of perks in order to raise money, such as, for example, being able to carry out certain imports without paying the same dues on it, which is one of the reasons why we had the spectacle of senior figures from the Afghan veterans movement being assassinated in contract hits to take over this privileged way of being able to import goods. So this is what happened with Afghanistan. Again, I would stress, this is what happened with a 0.35% participation rate, which Russia has already attained. And, think about this. The enemy was a result of two things. One was a lack of resources, and Russia is going to lack resources and likely will continue also to not privilege the veterans. Despite all the grand talk about how well they're going to be looked after, we're already seeing that veterans are not getting what they're entitled to, whether it's because of incompetence, penny-pinching, or corruption. This is likely to continue or actually get worse. But secondly, anomie, that sense of being alienated from your society and the values it's meant to instill. There's all this talk about the glories of the war and Russians standing up and demonstrating their selflessness and their heroism. And how does that compare with the reality? with the reality of officers who bug out at the first threat and but expect you to continue to sit there shivering in the trenches as cluster bomb munitions rain down around you, of failing to get anything like the kind of logistics, food and medical attention which you're meant to get. You know, all of these things in a war that you still don't really understand what the hell it's all about, when frankly, as far as you're concerned, you thought that your Ukrainians were basically your brothers. You know, put all this together, and again, we have a recipe for a similar, pretty substantial sort of wave of social dislocation. And in a future podcast, I'm going to drill down a little bit more directly on precisely what's happening with the organized crime scene. But one thing that's already noteworthy, which again I think the next generation of, shall we call them, Ukraintsi, veterans of the Ukrainian war, are going to contribute to, is the pressure on the current underworld status quo, precisely from what we could think of as insurgent gangs. The ones that are less involved in long-term partnerships over illicit markets and deals with corrupt local officials and things, but essentially the ones that are feeling violent, outsiders with least to lose. We have groups like the AUE, which is particularly a kind of youth prison subculture, which is now emerging outside the prison system. And I think we're also going to see Ukraintsi fitting into that. Willingness to use violence, less to lose, harder to penetrate for the police authorities, harder to control by the criminal authorities. It's a recipe for rather more mayhem on the streets. And as I said, a fair amount of this is driven by economics. Now, the Afghan war was affordable for the Soviet Union in the long term because it was, you know, as I say, relatively limited. There was a certain amount of money being spent on the war. There was a certain amount of money being spent on certain reconstruction projects in Afghanistan and such like. And obviously there were also some economic sanctions. But, you know, ultimately, this was not what the real problem was. It was precisely that the Soviet economy was, in any case, in terminal decline. In this case with Ukraine, on the one hand, look, it's much, much more expensive in terms of the actual war, but also in terms of the impact of sanctions, which it's a long-term thing, but we really mustn't fall victim to the assumption that sanctions don't work. They do work. They just don't work in the way that some of their boosters were suggesting, that it was some kind of magic silver bullet that would end the Russian Federation or Putin's war. So on the one hand, the costs are that much greater. But on the other hand, we also have to recognise the degree to which Russia went into Ukraine in a much, much stronger economic position than the Soviet Union was in 1979, let alone the mid-1980s. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily think it's going to be exactly the same. But what one can say is that a series of fundamental and systemic weaknesses of the Russian economy are being massively magnified by the impact of the war. So it started in a much higher, stronger position than the Soviet Union, but it's taking a much, much steeper downward curve as a result. And this kind of accelerated entropy, again, it's not necessarily going to bring down the system in itself, but what it does do, just as Afghanistan did for the Soviet regime, is in some ways make the choices harder. It means that you've precisely got less margin, less slack, so that when you're going to have to make decisions, they are going to be much more zero-sum. If you need to spend more money on, say, the military, or even on looking after veterans, that money is going to have to come from somewhere else. And if your system is already heavily geared, if you don't actually have the capacity to easily collect more money through taxes or whatever, then it means cuts in other places, and cuts in other places just simply transfer the potential discontent into other causes, other regions. I mean, this was one of the big problems with the Afghan experience in the health system, was when people were saying, no, we need to give the Afghan veterans, you know, proper access to healthcare facilities and such like. The response that came back from the Ministry of Health is, fine, who gets less then? You know, do we then mean that the workers who are suffering from industrial accidents, do we push them to the back of the queue or whatever else? You know, it's not as though these are going to be costs which do not impact on someone else. So again, this is where I think the war in Ukraine is going to bite the system, but often in unpredictable ways. It'll mean that precisely when suddenly new demands crop up, that will each time create a much sharper political choice. And this is the thing. Putinism, and Putin himself, is not good at making tough decisions of this sort, of making unpopular decisions, of decisions where there is no clear sort of positive outcome. So it tends to lead to paralysis. And I think that's going to be absolutely crucial. The Afghan war was one which actually the Soviet leadership under Gorbachev, they had a pretty good sense of what they wanted to do. Getting there was going to be sometimes difficult. But what they wanted to do was extricate themselves from this war, reduce the political costs, and in some ways use this as a springboard precisely to relaunch their relationship with the West. It was an obvious irritant, not just with the West, actually, but also, it's worth noting, with the Muslim world and with China. And so by pulling out of this war that had been going on long enough that it was almost regarded as a kind of a fixture of the international scene, Gorbachev gained credit. Putin cannot and will not gain credit for pulling out of Ukraine. No one's going to say, well, I mean, yes, he invaded Ukraine in the first place, but full marks for him for pulling out. No, of course not. There's no way he himself can accrue any advantages. Furthermore, he doesn't, I think, really know, have a clear sense of what he wants. I mean, sure, he has a wish list. I'm sure he'd like to see Ukraine neutered and controlled by Moscow, but yeah, that's not going to happen. But so there isn't that sort of clear sense of an outcome which other countries would find acceptable. You know, Afghanistan was fine with actually having the Soviets pull out. Afghanistan's neighbours were quite keen on the Soviets pulling out. And so they had an incentive to basically work with Moscow to find a way of achieving that. Given that Putin will almost certainly want, well, at the very least, he would want Crimea. I suspect he would want also the land bridge or any other territories. And also constraints on Ukraine's future. I don't think he's still kind of got his head round the idea of the, you know, a truly sovereign Ukraine making its own choices. Well, in those circumstances, what could Putin seek that other countries would want to encourage him and help him achieve? The answer is none. So I think we're going to see paralysis in terms of the overall political strategy as regards Ukraine. But we're also going to see paralysis at home because of all the tough choices. And all of this is going to serve to exacerbate the existing problems. Again, just like Afghanistan was not crucial for the Soviet Union, but exacerbated and brought to the forefront the deeper systemic problems with the Soviet system. So too, I think, with Ukraine. In terms of Putin's legitimacy, in terms of whether or not he actually does make decent decisions, decisions which are actually genuinely good for the country. In terms of the position of the economy, which by its increasing isolation from much of the global system and the additional costs it's having to bear as a result, is grinding down. About a fragmentation of the elite. And indeed, a fragmentation of the security apparatus. And here's a last little kind of parallel that I'd want to draw. The fragmentation of the Soviet security elite, the rise of people who were both, you know, extreme conservative nationalists, but also those who wanted to see genuine reform and even democratization. Well, I think that was one of the crucial elements behind not just the decision to have, but also the failure of the 1991 August coup, when a bunch of hardliners thought that they could just isolate Gorbachev, declare in effect that the clock was being rolled back to pre-reform era, and thought that actually they could make that stick on a country which was no longer willing to do so. Had they, in the very first day, been able to demonstrate the kind of ruthless brutality which the Soviet system had in the past, then they might have got away with it. Because in that first day, pretty much everyone, with a few exceptions, was holding their breath and waiting to see. But the point is, they didn't. And they didn't in part because Defense Minister Yazov wasn't willing to be the man who bathed himself in blood for the name of this coup. And indeed, many of the officials within the security apparatus, including the KGB, were opposed to it. You had the bizarre situation of literally on the same floor of the Lubyanka, people plotting moves to support the coup, while they were being spied on by others who would then pass on information to Boris Yeltsin, who was the sort of the main figurehead of opposition to the coup, all on one floor of the Lubyanka building. So the fragmentation of the security elite was crucial, I would suggest, to the failure of the 1991 August coup. The thing is, now, in some ways, Putin is in the position of the coup plotters, the so-called Vazmyorka, the Gang of Eight, in that, you know, he's actually trying to hold on to a conservative, I would suggest, retrograde model of the Russian Federation. And precisely it's because of the growing fragmentation of the security elite that is proving less and less convincing. I mean, we'll have to see what the long-term impacts of the Prigozhin mutiny are. But if nothing else, I think it demonstrated that in a vote of confidence in Putin, the security apparatus, in the main, chose to abstain. Well, that's not a secure long-term position for Putin or for the Russian Federation. So we'll have to see. So I think for all of these reasons, you know, it's worth drawing the comparisons between what otherwise look like very, very different kind of wars. But also, Afghanistan proved to be the Soviet Union's last foreign war. There were, you know, warlike examples of internal repression, but not a foreign war. There are those who worry that there could be further foreign wars after Ukraine. I honestly don't see how this system and this president survives this war, or at the very least survives the war with the capacity, political and military, to fight any further wars. So that is a little bit of optimism in its own sense. And as you hopefully know by now, I always like to end my podcasts on an upbeat note. Anyway, as I say, there won't be anything from me for probably about 2 weeks. I will speak to you in due course. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.
Czechia. We zijn weer terug op het Museumplein. Gisteren ook al, kwamen we van de Dam met de grote antiracisme demo. 21 maart. En vandaag is het 22. We staan aan de andere kant van het Museumplein. Bij de dichte rolluiken van het VS-consulaat. En hier zal zo meteen een demonstratie beginnen om 2 uur, een paar minuutjes nog.